This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. In Health and Living today, we're discussing heart attacks, whether or not you can predict a heart attack. It is the number one cause of death among both men and women in Malaysia, and knowing how to prevent it could possibly save your life. In the studio with me, consultant physician and cardiologist, Dr. Zubin Othman Ibrahim from Ara Damansara Medical Center. Welcome, Dr. Zubin. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Could you just quickly explain to me what a heart attack really is?
Okay, I think I'll just try and make it as simple as possible. It's what happens when one or say branch of a blood vessel, which is supplying a part of the heart, is suddenly blocked, and this can happen in a few minutes to hours, and that area which is not getting the supply will be starved of oxygen and blood supply. So that's a heart attack.
Okay, and and this can happen. This is happening in the heart, but it can happen in the brain as well. Am I correct?
It's a similar form of mechanism where you have something called a stroke, or sometimes it's termed a brain attack. But what happens is a bit different, where you have the source of the block or the thrombus or the blood clot is either from elsewhere, from the blood vessels around the neck area, or the blood vessels further downstream, and that causes a block further away in the branches of the brain. Somehow the anatomy of the brain is different with regards to the circulation to the heart, but the mechanism or the kind of patients who get a heart attack and stroke is very similar.
Okay, but we don't know why.
Not exactly. It's probably due to the fact that with strokes, there's a lot more play with hypertension, whereas in heart disease or heart attacks, it's both things like hypertension, diabetes, high cholesterol, and a few other major factors.
So you mentioned the vessels are deprived of blood flow is what you're saying, am I correct?
Yes.
And so then you have a heart attack. But what happens after that? I mean, you deprive the blood vessel of oxygen, and then what happens?
If
does it atrophy?
That's a scientific term which means that area of the heart slowly reduces in the function, and cell death occurs. So when you have a sudden block in the blood supplying one area of the heart, certain processes get to the blood vessel, really depending on the size of the vessel, on the branch, whether it's a main branch, whether it's a small branch, the body sometimes is able to clear off that clot on its own. And what may happen is you may just get a quick kind of chest pain, which after about 10, 15 minutes goes away. But if the block is permanent and then it goes on for a few hours, then that whole area of the heart will become dead tissue. And after a while, it becomes scar tissue. So this is the main kind of cause for something else, which is heart failure. For example, if you have a large area of heart which is dead or scar tissue, then that whole area does not function well. So the main cause of heart failure in the population is ischemic heart disease, where the patient has had a previous
heart attack,
for example.
Yeah. Okay. So you did say that sometimes after 10 minutes, the chest pain goes away. So does that mean it goes undetected, the heart attack? Is that considered a heart attack?
The criteria that we use for just diagnosing a heart attack is to actually see the changes on ECG, and then the symptoms, and also the evidence that there is cell death from a blood test. If you've heard of cardiac enzymes, for example, troponins. So if a patient has a large heart attack and the symptoms are very clear and the ECG is something which even a junior doctor can see, then you just have to say it's a heart attack. You may not need to do a blood test. But there are some situations where the pain is not typical, where the ECG is not as clear as a straightforward heart attack, then you may want to do a blood test in the emergency department. and then you will see the effects of the blood clot or the thrombosis, and that's where you can diagnose a heart attack. And it really depends on how long the blood clot has been there, the branch. There are some smaller branches which may cause chest pain, but it does not cause a large area of cell death or infarct. That's the term for heart attack.
So the heart releases an enzyme when it's undergoing a heart attack?
Yeah, so the heart is made of the cells which contract from time we are born until we expire. But when you have the cells actually being deprived of the oxygen, the cell releases its own kind of enzymes, and these are the ones which has been detected for years with research. It started off a long time ago, for example, things like myoglobin, and then it's CK, which is the creatine kinase, and now it's the newer ones, which is troponin. And all of this is specifically looking at the certain enzymes or proteins now, which is directly related to the cell of the heart, which is the myocardium.
Okay, and what determines whether a person will survive a heart attack or not?
Okay, so because the heart is made of mainly three large vessels, each of these vessels has got its branches, you may get a small heart attack. So most patients with a small heart attack may not suffer that bad. They may just think it's a form of upper GI discomfort, gastritis. But if it's large enough, then he may be really concerned, then he goes to hospital. So a large heart attack, if it's not treated well, then you are running the risk of, one, getting a large area which is infarcted, thus getting heart failure. But if it's large enough and there are some kind of vessels which originate from one huge one, for example, the left main vessel where it goes off into two vessels, and if you have a heart attack from that vessel, there's a high chance of death within the next few hours. So if you don't go to a hospital where you get the right treatment, then you are at a high risk of death. The other thing which is also something that we don't want to see is if the heart attack or the infarct, it can cause something called an arrhythmia, which is a really bad electrical disturbance of the heart, and that's when the patient's heart actually stops. And if that occurs outside the hospital, then the patient has got a very small chance of recovering from that.
I always understood arrhythmia as an irregular heartbeat.
It can be irregular. It can be very slow. It can be very fast. It can be a kind of a heartbeat which is not kind of producing a good cardiac output. So an arrhythmia means something which is not normal.
So when you say a heart attack in a small vessel or whether or not it's a big vessel, and how it presents is very different. But in both cases, would you say atrophy is actually happening?
To a certain extent, yes. But you know, you may not see it in the usual ways that you detect a heart attack. Either the blood levels are not that high. Either when you scan the heart, you don't see a large area which is not functioning. And the patient, after getting the treatment from a heart attack which is not treated well, may not feel any difference in his ability to exercise or to function. If you get a small heart attack and the pain goes away after a few hours, then he may go back to work. So that's a small heart attack, for example.
Okay. Yeah. What are the dangers of not detecting a small heart attack?
We always understand that if somebody is suffering from a small heart attack, the other vessels that he has are also in the same state. So he will be at further risk of getting a larger heart attack, for example. And if he does not detect one from a doctor, for example, he will not be on treatment which may be able to further reduce the risk or treat him well enough.
Okay. Yeah. And can you predict a heart attack? I mean, is it possible to reliably predict a heart attack?
Yeah, I think doctors are in the business or in the field of trying to do as much as possible to avoid somebody getting a heart attack. We all just understand that prevention is the main thing. So one of the ways how we prevent is to look at the traditional risk factors of the patient. And maybe 30, 40 years ago, when the first large-scale studies in the US, the Framingham heart study. They looked at family history, cholesterol, diabetes, hypertension, smoking, and we used that to predict risk. And then maybe about 10, 20 years ago, there are certain markers which showed that it could be used to further augment the function of these risk calculators, for example. And now there's a few other things that you can do, either looking at genes, for example, or maybe looking at how the vessels look like non-invasively, for example. So there's a whole range of ways how you would be able to predict whether or not somebody has got already heart disease or can have a heart attack in the future.
Okay, we'll come back and find out a little bit more about risk factors. I think we all know what the risk factors are, but as far as heart attacks are concerned. What's the ranking? What comes first? Is it family history? That's, you know, the strongest link. Is it smoking? Is it your diet? And a lot of us think that stress is up there, but is it really? We'll come back and find out more up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I am Meera Sevisodi. In our Health and Living segment, Dr. Zubin Othman Ibrahim, a consultant physician and cardiologist from Ara Damansara Medical Center. We're discussing whether or not you can predict a heart attack. Dr. Zubin, you were talking about the risk factors just now and whether or not you can predict someone's, how reliably can you predict somebody's actually, you know, going to get a heart attack or is predisposed to a heart attack. But risk factors, I think, play a huge role in this, and we know the list, but what comes, you know, in terms of priority, is there really a list that you can give us?
Yeah, I think from the science that we know for the past 50, 60 years, the main ones will be, you might be surprised by its age. So that's one. So if you look at all the risk factors, which has been done by the Europeans and the Asians and the Americans, I think age is number one. And then you have the major risk factors like cigarette smoking, diabetes and hypertension and high cholesterol or just a form of dyslipidemia. For us to rank which one is more important, we know that from different generations, different races and different cultures, each risk factor has got a different weightage. For example, in a woman, things like diabetes and obesity would be higher risk factor scores, for example, as opposed to cigarette smoking and high cholesterol. And why does it happen? We don't really know exactly. It may be that certain race and certain genders are able to offset their risk factors more. I know I'm generalizing, but for example, maybe females don't use energy as much as in a physical energy. But then you see men who are smoking and they are playing sports, and that cigarette smoking itself is still a huge risk factor, even mm-hmm. though they are not obese, even though they are playing sports. So for us to rank exactly which one is most important, I think we know that there is a whole cluster of risk factors which is important, and in each kind of subgroups, even in one country, you may have a different ranking. It's not for us to say which one is most important. Mm-hmm. I think we have to know that there's never one person who has got heart disease because of one risk factor.
Okay, but if you sort of manage the overall risks, can you reduce or address the possibility of having a heart attack?
Yeah, I think we'll just, for example, get one example. For example, cigarette smoking. A 50-year-old male who's been smoking for the last 20 years, if he stops cigarette smoking, within 1 year, he's able to reduce his risk factor by half, that means by 50%. And this is something huge. And if he understands that just by cutting the risk factor by 50%, he's able to add in a few years, for example. And it's not just the years. It's the additional risk that he is with further age.
Okay. And, you know, you spoke about dyslipidemia just now, and I think in the very general terms, we know it as cholesterol issues.
Yes.
Your LDL and your, good cholesterol, bad cholesterol, HDL. But there's so much controversy out there. Some research papers will tell you that cholesterol does not increase your risk of dying from heart disease. Some say cholesterol does. What's your take on it?
It is something that I don't think we will exactly know the answer each time when somebody asks that, because research is an ongoing thing. There's knowledge, there's new knowledge every time we open up new journals, for example. But what we know is it's one of the major risk factors. And where, for example, a person has abnormal levels of cholesterol because of faulty gene, for example, diet somehow is one of the most sought-after ways for doctors to tell the patients you need to improve things. But maybe it's not that important. Maybe it's a mixture of both genes and diet and our exercise. But what we know is in a patient who has already got a heart attack, where there's proven to be for some disease in his vessels, somebody post-bypass, these are the patients that we need to target. Where there's a lot of debate, and it's something which is quite clear, is patients who do not have heart disease, who may have a few other risk factors, and if you find some cholesterol which is high, do you treat that? I think this is the main issue which doctors are not clear yet, researchers are not clear yet. And sometimes we do see from press or from WhatsApp and Facebook that the issue gets a bit clouded. Statins may not be all that useful in somebody where you want to prevent a heart attack, but certainly there's plenty of numbers, kind of good hard evidence that shows that it is useful in somebody who's already had a heart attack, for example. So okay. I think the public need to read, I mean, I can ask the patient to read journals as well. That's up to me, for example. But as long as we are able to get the right information, unbiased, and with good advice, then I think the patient will be a lot more kind of convinced that there's something that he can do about it, not just us giving pills.
Most cardiologists are for statins. I mean, and I suppose it's just to play safe. To be on the safe side, in the statin is always given out when you have higher cholesterol levels. So you obviously have a very different take on this.
I am for statins if the patient has got a bypass.
Already had a bypass.
Had a bypass. I am for statins if I've shown that he has got bad vessels, for example, and significant risk factors. For example, he has diabetes and also high cholesterol plus really strong family history of heart disease. But if I see somebody who's 40 years old, 45, he smokes, he doesn't do exercise, he's a bit obese, and he's got high cholesterol, I will make sure that he understands that I can't give him statins just to make him live longer. You know, he has to make sure that he stops his cigarette smoking, that he has to do something about his diet. And the statins is something which will only reduce his future risk of heart disease by, at the most, 3%, 5%. And if you see somebody who's only 40 years old, his risk is not more than 10%. So I think if you do the math, it's only a small reduction in his risk.
So it's the other modifiable factors that need to be taken into account as well.
Yes, because it's never just one thing in most 60 years old. And those are the patients who really come in with bad disease. The younger ones, you know, we have to make sure that they understand lifestyle kind of factors are more important than just looking at numbers.
What about the older people? What about the older woman, for an example?
Yeah, so we do see that patients and older, I would say 65 and above. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so 65 and above.
Postmenopausal.
Yeah, so their hormones are not kind of protective anymore for heart disease. They have hypertension, they have diabetes. So we would treat them the same as any men. The problem is they may have symptoms which are not as clear as a male person. But once you are at a certain age and you already have more than a few risk factors, then we treat them same as a male patient. We have to make sure that if they have any symptoms, we do test them. Statins are not one which you should be just giving out free, for example, it's something which needs to be really thought of, because it's known to have maybe some side effects, and the amount of bad press that we can get from just a doctor just giving out drugs can be more damaging to the patient, for example.
We also have heard of the link between inflammation and heart attacks, and that can be measured to predict your risk as well. You want to just explain what inflammation is here?
Yeah, so this is something which is certainly not new. I think since the early 80s, there's been plenty of research which shows that in somebody with multiple risk factors, there's an ongoing kind of background inflammation in the vessels, and that can be seen in the cells which is lining the heart vessels, which are filled with plaque, for example. And we'll just go straight to the marker which has been shown to be useful for us to quantify the inflammation, which is the CRP or the HS, high sensitivity CRP, sorry. And if you look at the kind of patients who have got disease and the whole spectrum, from somebody with just multiple risk factors, somebody with heart disease but no symptoms, somebody with significant heart disease and who is having a heart attack, all of these patients will have a raised CRP as opposed to somebody who does not have symptoms or signs. And what it shows is that all of the risk factors that we have, the diabetes, hypertension, and the high cholesterol, they may be thought of as, you know, substrates for whatever process that is occurring. And one of the main process is the inflammation. For us to target just inflammation, again, it's like the whole story of just targeting cholesterol or just targeting high sugars. We need to look at the whole process. Inflammation is, I think, a process which is seen in somebody with heart disease. For example, I think one of the universities in this country, there was a master's kind of project which looked at least 8,000 subjects in the rural population. They looked at these are people without any heart disease, and they just measured the CRP, and it was high, and it was more than 2.4. And the main thing which showed why they had a high CRP was there were two factors. One was obesity, and one was pre-diabetes, and these were mainly in obese women. So simple things like obesity, diabetes, that really ramps up the total background inflammation that you have in your body.
Okay. What about stress? I think a lot of people talk about stress and how stress is killing a lot of us. But when you talk about heart attacks, how much does stress contribute to cardiovascular disease?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I think with stress, it's really hard to quantify. Each person has got their own kind of limits. Each person has got their own way of dealing with stress. But I don't think we have got hard ways to say that stress directly causes heart attacks. What certainly occurs is, you know, in somebody with a certain form of personality or kind of background behavior, they may not react to stress in the right way, and it's what you do with the stress. So indirectly, yes, you don't exercise, you have bad diets, you smoke. But exactly, does it really cause inflammation? There may be some smaller studies which show that it does happen, but I don't think it is something that we can really measure. And because it's something which is harder for doctors to measure, then maybe it gets kind of sidestepped. But I think it's something which still needs some further research.
Okay, but it does, in the whole mix, it does possibly contribute some amount as well.
In me, yes.
Okay, we're still not sure about it. What does smoking actually do to the blood vessels?
Okay, so the toxins that we have in cigarette smoking, I think there's some interesting research as well. Even with one cigarette, it increases the inflammation. that you have, and somebody who smokes cigarettes, and you add on with things like hypertension and diabetes, there's clear inflammation in the blood vessels which is supplying the heart, and these toxins may be from the CO, from the carbon monoxide. It may be from the toxins which is added on to the cigarette during its manufacturing process. It's something which is as clear as the cause of heart attacks that we see when we see these patients who do smoke. It's I don't think we can refute what is happening in these patients. Exactly what happened, I don't think I can explain to you now, but it is the process which occurs when somebody smokes for a long time.
With research coming out so quickly and all the time, how do you keep track with all the developments that's happening?
It is difficult, but as a doctor, I guess you have to make sure you do get updated with whatever you can, be involved in the societies which is, you know, specific to your field, and also the other things which is also useful. But you know, we have plenty of information systems that we can assist us in trying to figure out whether or not somebody who you are seeing needs extra diagnosis, kind of aids, and kind of the management kind of issues. But you know, there's a lot of things that we have to filter out. Whether is this new information? Is this old information? Is this relevant? And it is by making sure that we are up to date.
Do you see artificial intelligence coming in to make your life a lot easier? Because I know that with oncology there is such a system. It helps with the diagnosis. Of course, the doctor makes the final call on it. But you know, artificial intelligence just does help weed out and help you with the diagnosis a lot faster.
Yeah, it's quite surprising that since the 80s there have already been systems and the models of machine learning in States and Europe, but sometimes it has not kind of lifted off. The data which has been used for the machine learning kind of systems, it has already been in place, but it's never caught on by either hospital administrators, by universities, by doctors. Why there's a few kind of stumbling blocks, I think over the years, we see that the amount of data that we have, either if it's just the notes, information with regards to images, for example, these things need to be updated and put into forms where the AI is able to get us the good information. We can only get good outcomes from this AI if the information is being put in well. Yes, I think the Watson system has been shown to be useful, but it's not been used yet kind of widely. And there has been still a debate as in where exactly does AI need to be used? Is it during the diagnosis, or is it more of updating the doctor when the patient needs to come in for a recheck? Because in most patients and in most situations, the diagnosis bit can be well looked after by the doctor. It is the other things which is more kind of difficult. The choice of treatment, for example, the choice of the follow-up and the next step for investigation. I don't think we are there yet, where we know exactly where does AI or things like neural networks, whether or not these things can be used now. I don't think we are there yet. It's really interesting, even with all the. For example, even with all the cardiac risk scores that we have, there's at least five or six of them. And if we take a population, say a GP population, I think the uptake for the risk scores is less than 10%. So even though we have something relatively straightforward to use, I don't think we are using it well enough.
Okay. Diet and exercise. As you mentioned, your stand is, when it comes to giving out statins, if the person who is in the high-risk group already, who is obese, you know, smoking, and if they don't want to change those modifiable factors or they want to address it, then there's really no point dishing out statins. So it's going to reduce your risk very little compared to being obese and smoking. So diet and exercise, have you How easy has it been getting people to change their lifestyle?
I've been surprised by, say, my own patients, because some of them are really keen to change.
I mean, but they're patients already.
No, we have a practice where some of them are still well. They are just there for a checkup, for example. They may have some risk factors, but it's not severe. They're not sick yet. So I think in my practice, for example, I think 40%, 30% of them are still well.
Because you're a physician.
Yes.
And cardiologist.
And of the setting that we are in, say a private setting.
Okay.
Whereas when I was still in the university, in the public, I think maybe 90% of them do actually have heart disease.
Okay.
So for these patients, I think it is they are looking for you. They want to see you because they want to be well. And some of them are quite keen to start an exercise program, for example. Some of them are keen to change their risk factors and to kind of try to make sure that they don't get heart disease in the future. There's no way we can kind of give up on them yet. You know, we do have to try. We do have to show that it is something that they can. And occasionally we do use techniques where we tell them, if you do this, you will see a change, and you will see a change in your blood test, because patients are really keen to look at numbers. And it's not perfect, but if you show them that after 2 or 3 months of real good exercise and just cutting their tetare, it does change their sugars and maybe their TGs. You know?
That's all it takes.
That it may be small, but it does work.
It makes a big difference.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Just cut down their tetare. cut down the sugar.
Yes, carbs.
I mean, we consume a lot of sugar as a nation.
Yes.
A lot of sugar.
It's embarrassing.
It is embarrassing.
Yeah.
Honestly, it is.
Yeah.
So we've spoken at length about heart attacks. I think we know it's about your genes. It's about smoking, your lifestyle, your diet, your stress level. Okay, stress level's still in limbo. We still don't know whether it contributes in a big way or not. But
yeah,
we do know that your age, obesity, smoking are huge contributing
yes
factors towards a heart attack. What will be your message to all of us?
I think there's a lot of things that we can do to improve our health. It does take some steps, but these steps can start off small. With time, we can kind of prevent heart disease as much as we want to, mm-hmm, I think.
Okay. Yeah. And what do you do? What do you do to maintain a healthy heart?
Okay. I mean, I try my best not to take too much carbs. Rice maybe once a day at the most.
Mm-hmm.
And then sweet drinks, I try my best not to. Occasionally, once a week. But, things like running, exercise. There's a plan for me to go up a mountain in, say, January for ice climbing.
But why?
Jaunt. Because we can. it's one way that we can be excited about something.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a motivating factor
more
than anything.
I do have some posters of me climbing in my clinic, and my patients, they ask. And when they ask, I tell them, this is how I do it.
Okay, all right. But you don't really need to climb and go up mountains on ice and whatever not.
I mean, yeah, it's
small things make a big difference.
Yeah, but this is one of them. And if I have something maybe quite huge in front of me, I think it makes me a bit more kind of motivated.
Excited.
Yeah.
Okay, but it can be a deterrent for some. It can be demotivating for some people.
Yeah, yes. I think when we look at how people who are successful, when they do the exercise every day, I mean, they are really motivated. Some can spend maybe half an hour on the treadmill, some can't. And I think it's you really have to personalize what you need to do. Not everybody can swim well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think really understand what you need to do for yourself to be as healthy as possible, I think.
Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Dr. Zubin Uthman Ibrahim, consultant, physician and cardiologist from Ara Damansara Medical Center, speaking to us about whether or not you can predict a heart attack on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.